pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Rebecca Watson filling in for Jeff Poor, FM Talk 106.5. Thank you for joining us. Our next guest will be Austin Sidwell, and he'll be here around the 10:20 time frame. So you've just got me. Dan has left, and now I'm sitting here by myself. So a few things I saw that I thought were interesting is that the commission... The ballot commission finalized summaries for four constitutional amendments for the November general election ballot on Tuesday. And so these are going to be added to the ballot. And a lot of the times when I'm voting and reading these constitutional amendments, they don't make any sense. But these seem to be pretty straightforward. One is regarding the lieutenant governor vacancy. And this was a constitutional amendment. It comes from Senate Bill 271. And that is basically to provide for the election of a lieutenant governor if the office of lieutenant governor becomes vacant during the first 2 years of a term. And then it also authorizes the legislature to set the salary of the lieutenant governor and the officers of the legislature. And then it also will require any expenditure of legislative funds for travel to be approved by a legislative officer. And I don't have to say, I don't really know how it's currently done, but that might be something to research before you vote yes or no on that particular amendment. Then the second one is a statewide constitutional amendment, and that is for our school system consolidation guidelines. And this is actually interesting to me because Baldwin County is a huge county, and we have one district, and there is always talk of our cities breaking away and starting their own school system. So what this would do, it comes from House Bill 380, and this would it would provide a process for the creation of a consolidated county school system by merging two or more county boards of education. And it would require the State Board of Education to conduct an impact study on the potential effects of the consolidation. So right now in Baldwin County, there has been an impact study done by the city of Fairhope. They did one, and then there's a private one that was done. So I guess with this, they would basically require the State Board of Education to conduct it, which I think is interesting. And it would require publication of the impact study. So I think that that's a good idea because it's always nice to read what they're thinking and how it might impact people. You know, for instance, are my taxes going to go up? That's always the question. But it says that if it's for two or more districts or cities. So I'm very, very interested to read and learn more about this. But it would provide a procedure for protesting it as well. So I think that that's always good when you have a system because people sometimes read these things and things are happening in your community and you don't even know how to stop it. So I actually like that amendment. And then there's another statewide constitutional amendment regarding the Pledge of Allegiance and student-led, student-initiated prayer in public schools. And that comes from House Bill 511. And it would require local boards of education to adopt policies requiring each public K-12 school to recite the Pledge of Allegiance and to the United States flag at the beginning of each school day, and to require local boards of education to adopt a policy authorizing student-initiated and student-led prayer. I don't know when we stopped saying the Pledge of Allegiance in schools, but especially in Alabama. But I think that should be a must for sure. And then the student initiated and student led prayer. I don't see the harm that that could cause, but I do probably looking at it from, you know, another perspective. I can see that there probably will be pushback on that. But I fully support it. I think it's a great idea. And I would be very interested in how that would be implemented and how the kids would, you know, when that would happen and where that would happen. Those would be my questions. And then broadcasting the first stanza of the Star Spangled Banner at least once a week during school hours. I can't imagine why that would be a bad idea. And I think that my only question would be when. And I believe that the schools would have the option to decide when that would happen. So I can't think of a reason why that would be a bad idea either. So moving on, I am very, very interested in this AI in public schools. And I know that Senator Tuberville has said that we're getting AI in our schools, and you know, that's kind of been something that I am not crazy about. So I have taken some time to, you know, specifically look at what's going on in Baldwin County. And I'm thinking that if this is what's happening in Baldwin County, it's probably happening throughout the entire state. But in November of 2023, the Alabama State Department of Education had an AI summit. And then basically they just kind of talked about what they were going to do, how they want to integrate it. They also provided an AI template to local school districts. I couldn't find a publicly available agenda, speakers, or recording, or any parent information on this. So I've just basically spent time looking at Baldwin County schools, specifically looking at their agendas, looking at, you know, trying to figure out, are they doing AI? What's happening? And so they basically, in Baldwin County, they committed approximately $139,500 for 31,000 user licenses for Magic School AI. And that was October 1st, 2025. That's the date of the invoice. And so it looks like then after they committed that amount of money and bought those user licenses, we actually have almost 31,000 students in our public schools in Baldwin County. So I'm assuming that's one for every student that we have. So that would include elementary kids. November, they put an AI policy on the BCBE website. So they put the policy after they purchased the user licenses. Which I find interesting because there was no notification to parents. You know, it's almost sometimes feels like this stuff is, it's very sneaky the way that it's being done. And then I looked at their policies and it says that AI systems are defined as software programs that have AI built into them. A software programs that are fully AI or an AI product model. Anyway, we'll talk more about that when we come back. This is Rebecca Watson filling in for Jeff Poor, FM Talk 106.5. Stick around.
Knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind, but Mama tried.
Get on me, wanna know, Hank, why do you drink?
This is Rebecca Watson filling in for Jeff Poor, FM Talk 106.5. He will be back tomorrow. So I'm your last guest host, and I'm sure you're looking forward to hearing from him. Before the break, we were talking about AI in our public schools, and I was just kind of reading a little blurb from the AI policy for Baldwin County schools. And it basically says the preliminary or I guess the primary goal of the Baldwin County Board of Education's AI policy is to integrate AI into the pre-K through 12 education system in a way that responsibly maximizes its benefits while mitigating its risks. The use of AI in pre-K to 12 schools aims to cater to individual learning and teaching methods, enabling students to think critically about AI applications and use them for research and problem solving. We've got that. So we've got an invoice. You know, we know they're putting it in the school in Baldwin County, for sure. It's happening. But the one question I always have is privacy. How are they protecting these kids' privacy? I mean, we've got lawsuits going on with iReady, which is a program that has been used for years in public school. We have a lawsuit against Canvas, which is and PowerSchool. These are three applications that are used in our public schools, and it's for harvesting these kids' data. And so here's part of, you know, the concern for me is that these parents weren't notified that AI is going on in the schools. They're also not notified that basically their kids' information is not private. And this is also part of the technology policy that Baldwin County Schools has. Staff and students should not have any expectation that their usage of such resources is private. Reasonable efforts will be taken to maintain security of technology resources, but BCBOE cannot ensure that such security will be penetrated or breached. And they're not going to accept any liability for any of that if it does happen. So I think that, you know, what we have to realize that, yes, AI's here, you know, it's coming into our schools, but we have a responsibility to protect our kids, and that should be the first priority. And parents should definitely be part of that process. So coming up, we're going to welcome Austin Sidwell, and I guess he's on the phone right now. He's not in studio. He's actually, you know, running for Congressional District 1, and he's very busy, but he's taken some time to be with us. Austin, are you there?
Yes, ma'am. I'm here. How are you doing, Rebecca?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great.
You hanging
glad
in
to be
there?
On. Oh, yeah.
I feel like...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was saying I feel like this congressional, you know, these lines were moved, and it's like you guys have just been running a congressional marathon with campaigning. It's almost over. You know, August 11th is the big day for everyone to go vote. I bet you're looking forward to that.
I am. I'm excited to see what happens. Like we've been. Being first time candidate, being really grassroots, getting out there, learning this process, never been in it before. As frustrating as the extension was when you're ready for it to be over, we were glad, really feel blessed to get more time to get our message out, which is exactly what we've done since the May Ghost primary. And the response has been awesome. I'm reinvigorated just, you know, getting out and being with people, but definitely ready to see what happens, ready to see what God has in store next.
Good. I'm so grateful that you didn't just sit there and complain. You know, you got up and you're not a politician, and you decided to take a chance, and you've worked really hard. And so, I've gotten, you know, to know you through various conversations we've had. There are some questions that I do have. One of Congress's primary responsibilities is the federal budget. So, we provide Israel with approximately $3.8 billion annually in security assistance. And Congress has also approved additional funding through supplemental appropriations at various times. So it is a lot more than $3.8 billion. But at the same time, many Americans are struggling with the rising cost of groceries, housing, healthcare, while this federal the federal minimum wage has remained at $7.25 an hour since 2009. And Alabama goes along with the federal minimum wage. We don't have our own state standard set. So what do you believe Congress's spending priorities should be? And should additional foreign aid continue to take precedence? Or should Congress focus first on addressing the economic challenges facing hardworking Americans here at home first?
Well, absolutely. I think that Congress should focus on America, Americans, America first. That's what the whole movement was. I mean, that's why many of us, you know, jumped on board with Trump. Was his whole thing was that he was going to switch the idea of putting foreign interests, putting the global economy first, and swap to putting Americans first. And you know, you mentioned spending $3.8 billion annually on Israeli assistance, security assistance. And okay, that's fine. I support, you know, funding our allies where it makes sense. My problem is we don't know where all of that money goes. All I want is accountability and transparency for where my tax dollars are going, right? So locally here, we talk about a $3.2 billion bridge project on I-10 in Mobile, and we act like that's something that is so far beyond what Congress or what the federal government can do. And yet, like you said, every single year we're sending $3.8 billion overseas. And that's just a drop in the bucket of the overall spending that we're doing across various domains, right? And there is national security interest there. There is things that we have to do. I'm not necessarily an isolationist, but America's got to take care of its people first, right? One of the things that I have a problem with, you look at the project over there, and one of the things that we thought we were getting was an addition to the Bayway, something that would help with the congestion there. And rather, this is a bridge project that's going over the bay to eventually probably take the tunnels away so that they can increase the size of the port. That's all good things. But again, we keep putting the American people last. We keep putting the individuals last. We keep putting, you know, the interest of us here in the communities last. And so, you know, I'm not going to say that, you know, $7.25 as a federal minimum wage is good money. You can't live off of it. I get that. I'm, as a small business owner or a small business guy, like, we can't allow the federal government to dictate those things, but they have to stop hamstringing small businesses, right? We've got to stop inflating our dollars so that when you do get paid a wage, it goes further, right? We see our dollar just inflate, and the value of it decreases every single time that we spend money that we don't have. And so that's where I think the responsibility of Congress is. It should be focusing on spending money here that helps us, and then we go back and then look at the global stage and attack that next.
Okay. That makes sense. And, you know, these are questions that I think people have, and, you know, we don't get the answer that makes, you know, we get a political answer. And I appreciate just a human answer that makes actual sense. Thank you for that. When
we do need some more common sense up there.
I think so.
I don't think we've had that in a long time.
Are you nervous about, you know, if you're elected, you know, going, it just seems like, you know, people get elected and then they go, especially to D.C., and then they get, something happens to them up there. How are you going to, you know, how are you going to keep your small town, you know, promise to all these people?
Well, I'll be honest with you, it's because I feel like God's put me here for whatever reason, and I don't want to be there for forever. Like, this isn't, I equate it to the corporate ladder, right? Like, mm-hmm. I'm not going up there to climb some political ladder. I'm going up there to do, you know, the job that people elect me to do. If for some reason I don't get stuff done because the establishment is pushing back, then fine.
Gotcha.
Like, I'm going to go up there and represent people.
Gotcha. We'll be right back. This is Rebecca Watson hosting the Jeff Poor Show, 106.5 FM.
I'm Eastbound, just watch my bandit run. Keep your foot hard on the pedal. brakes. Tell my mind them brakes. Let it all hang out, cause we got a run to make.
Amarillo by morning, up from San
back. This is Rebecca Watson filling in for Jeff Poor, FM 106.5. Hey, if you have any questions for Austin, you can text at 251-343-0106. We may not have time to get to him, but if you leave an email or something like that in the text, I will make sure to pass it on to Austin, and he would be happy to answer your questions. All right, Austin, my next question for you is in regards to immigration and national security.
Right.
You're a military guy, and
yes,
so
ma'am.
I know that, you know, immigration and national security remain major concerns for many Americans. Across the country, some communities have experienced significant demographic changes, including growth in Muslim populations, mosques, Islamic schools, businesses, and community organizations. In Alabama, I think we have over 30 mosques. I know we have one in Baldwin County. And then, you know, examples often cited include communities in New Jersey. I mean, people can look this up. New Jersey, Dearborn, Michigan, New York City, obviously, Chicago, Houston, Dallas, Philadelphia, L.A., Boston, Raleigh, Nashville, Columbus, San Francisco, Atlanta, Washington, D.C., parts of Maryland, Northern Virginia. I mean, they're just pop. It's everywhere. And, you know, I've seen videos where they're chanting in the streets, and, you know, it's very concerning. And many of these metropolitan areas now have multiple mosques and Islamic centers, full-time schools. I mean, grocery stores, the halal grocery stores and restaurants, books, Islamic bookstores, clothing stores, you know, large Ashura processions. So here in Alabama, we recently saw a State Board of Education meeting where the governor cast the tie-breaking vote, you know, on history textbooks. And there was an example of, you know, that during the State Board of Education meeting, there was, you know, a speaker who basically kind of gave her take on what was in these history books, and she did not want these books. Like she just didn't think it was appropriate. Excuse me. And so I'd like to play a little clip of what she said, and then we can talk about that. I'd love your opinion.
Okay.
I want to raise serious concerns about the proposed textbooks. What is most alarming is that these issues I'm about to mention were discovered during a brief and limited review of the materials. If this many problems surface so quickly, it raises a troubling question. What else might be in these books that we simply didn't have time to find? Several examples illustrate this concern. There appears to be an imbalance of how religions are presented. In a seventh grade text, Christianity's spread is mainly linked through colonization and conquest, while Islam is described mostly through trade and cultural exchange. Muhammad is described as honest and kind, and there is little mention of Islam's military expansion or treatment of conquered peoples. This presents an incomplete and misleading view of history. Second, we found clear political bias in modern history sections. One eighth grade text places former President Trump in a section labeled threats to democracy, directly alongside authoritarian leaders such as Kim Jong-un.
Okay. So
that's crazy.
That's crazy.
That's crazy.
And so
can I parse this out just a little bit? So the first kind of section of the question, when we talk about immigration and national security, first of all, our immigration and policy has to reflect, you know, a focus on people who are willing to come here and assimilate to our culture and our values, right? Like, it doesn't mean you have to believe all the same things. It doesn't mean that you even have to have any fundamental beliefs, but you have to have a core willingness to say, you know, we all say the Pledge of Allegiance. You have to pledge to this country. You have to respect the values, and this country was built on like Western values, Judeo-Christian values, right? Like those values are the foundation of our country. And when you come here, you may not believe that on a religious standpoint, but you have to adhere to the laws in which those are founded. When we talk about some of the Muslims that are coming in, you know, it's kind of a, people act like it's kind of a tricky subject to kind of navigate because of the First Amendment and stuff like that. The free exercise clause allows you to practice religion freely if it doesn't impede on everyone else. And when you talk about Sharia law, when you talk about some of the things that are happening in some of the communities you discussed, they are encroaching and trying to enact Sharia law and enact their way of life to supersede our laws here. And that's a problem. And it's not allowed underneath our Constitution. So we need people congressionally to be willing to stand up and say that, and say, you know, something that may not be culturally popular here to say, but it's okay. It's okay to reflect that we want people here that are willing to adhere to American culture and actually want to be in our country, not change it. And I'll go into the second part with the Board of Education. It makes me think of the whole adage, like, history's written by the winner. Mm-hmm. And as Christians, we have lost the cultural war for so long, right, that we're seeing that play out in the way in which our kids are being taught. Mm-hmm. So Christians, if you want a society to reflect your values, then you have to start affecting society. I tell that, I've spoken with a lot of churches. Like there's some people still have that old adage of, you know, the church doesn't need to get involved in politics. The church kind of needs to stay in its own realm. No, we should be affecting society at the ground level so that we can win the cultural war, so that we can show people that there's a better way than what the left has pushed on us for decades.
Exactly. And I do want to make the point that just because the State Board of Education approved those textbooks, and it was, the governor was the tiebreaker to approve them, doesn't mean that each local board of education has to implement them. So just short, like I think it was maybe 2 days later, Baldwin County Board of Education unanimously voted to use this textbook. And I think the one thing that, I mean, obviously, there's several things that were said in that clip that I played, but, you know, all of our textbooks are now online for these kids. And so as a parent, you're not seeing, you know, they're not bringing home a book. And it's really hard as a parent to know what is my kid being taught? And, and so I think that's why this culture, it's so difficult to put your finger on, because you don't see it. You know, it's not like they're bringing home their paper. Everything is on that Chromebook. So it's unfortunately.
I mean, I guess in my own home, I mean, we got a 15-year-old. When his Chromebook doesn't go in his room, right? Like it actually sits in my office on my desk. If he's working on the computer, even at 15 years old, like, He has guardrails.
Yeah.
Like, things are here. It's in the open. And that's, I mean, that's what my parents did with me. We were kind of new into the whole computer age and having assignments that had to be typed out on the computer. And we had a family computer. And you came down. You didn't have, right now, you know, parents wants to get people or kids smartphones with access to the internet and let them go off with it alone. Don't do it. Parents have the choice of just saying no.
It's crazy to me because they won't let their kids get on their bike and ride their bike two blocks over because they're worried something could happen to them, but they'll hand them a cell phone where that's way more dangerous. One last question real quick, because we don't have a lot of time, but,
okay,
you know, another one of Congress's primary responsibilities is oversight of the federal government. So AI and data centers are becoming major issues across the country. What role should the federal government play in protecting Americans from potential impacts such as increased energy demand, water use, environmental concerns, noise, you know, effects on local communities, protecting private property rights while still encouraging innovation and economic growth?
Well, I mean, I think you got to start with the first, like, that we don't need the federal government trying to force these on communities. contrary to popular belief, like the community still know what's best for them, right? And we have to listen to them. So I don't like the federal government trying to force these. I mean, we see it all over District 1. Whether it's, you can look at any of those type in that realm, you know, solar farms, data centers, any of that. It's not about the specific technology. It's not about, you know, there's a need or not a need. It's about the fact that we aren't even letting our communities know that these are coming in until they're practically done deals. And that's not okay. And that's not right. And the federal government doesn't have a right to come into our communities and force things down our throats. Specifically, Congress doesn't need to subsidize these. If these are new technologies, if solar really is efficient, as we've all been kind of led to believe, then let it be efficient on its own. Stop subsidizing it and see what happens.
All right. Thank you, Austin. As always, a pleasure. I appreciate your time. And don't forget to vote on August 11th. And I hope you guys have a great day. And this is Rebecca Watson filling in with Jeff for Jeff Poor. We'll be right back.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time.
Welcome back. This is Rebecca Watson filling in for Jeff Poor, FM 106.5. We have a guest joining us, another guest, Angelo Fermo, who is Baldwin County Commissioner District 2 and also the Republican nominee for the Alabama Republican State Executive Committee. Welcome, Angelo.
Hey, Rebecca.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. Hope y'all are having a good day. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for making the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so there's this a lot of talk about this big Baldwin County master plan.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I just saw an article yesterday where, you know, it was being talked about that the master plan, I know it's trying to, like, kind of get it through right now before the new commission takes effect. So what do you think about that? Do you think they should hold off until, you know, the new commission gets on? Or
I think they should. I think they need to. I mean, I think there has to be a master plan because you have to control the growth of the county and you have to have a projection of what it looks like. And, you know, those things need to be in place. And I'm definitely not saying that the current plan has any flaws or any issues in it. You know, but that's a conversation for another day that we have to look at. But The thing with the master plan on that is in Baldwin County as a community, we kind of got to talk to all the stakeholders in it, you know, and some of the major stakeholders, like, you know, all the mayors kind of hadn't been looped in on it. And so, you know, a lot of the mayors, you know, wanted to pause it. And I know they all signed a letter asking the commission to pause this item and kind of shelve it for a little bit to give them time to look at it and get their, you know, planning and zoning departments to kind of engage with it. Same thing with a lot of the farmers that have a lot of land that the current plan would, you know, kind of address their property. And some people have thousands of acres, and so they kind of spoke up against it. So you have a combination of pretty much all the mayors in the county and a lot of the farmers as well that have spoken out to just kind of pause it and just kind of give them the opportunity to just look at it, you know, and get their input. And I agree with them, to be honest with you. I know they've been working on this for over a year, the Baldwin County has. And I think that they need to have their say into it too, because we all live together and it's all going to affect all of us. So I think everybody should be able to be looped in on it and all have a say in it.
What is the master plan? You know, what does that include for people who don't know?
The master plan shows the controlled growth, what areas they, you know, you want to keep, you know, green and, for, you know, and as far as the way the roads are going to develop and how they project, you know, urban sprawl and stuff throughout a lot of the cities and the areas, you know, where do we think the roads are going to go? What areas do we want to focus on for preservation and stuff like that? And it's the overall growth projection of what the county is going to be at, you know, years from now.
So do you think that data centers are, you know, taken into consideration in all of this?
No, that's not even in that plan. No, not at all. You know, it's not even mentioned in that in anything, or, you know, because I know that's obviously a hot topic in Alabama, but no, the Baldwin County Commission has, you know, nothing in the master plan with data centers.
Okay. So I know how supportive you are of the farmers, and across the county, residents, farmers, and ranchers have raised concerns about these data centers. I think, you know, the water for sure is a huge concern, especially for the farmers. They need that, right, to do what they do. So our water resources, the higher electricity demand, noise from the cooling systems and backup generators, you know, pollution concerns. I even saw a story where there's a farmer who they put a data center near his farm, and he hasn't had one calf that has been born alive since they did that. So I think there are, you know, definite concerns, even with, you know, increased traffic, especially on rural roads, and just changes to the character of the environment and the quality of life of the agricultural communities. So how do we encourage responsible development while protecting our farmers and ranchers and property owners and the heritage?
That's going to be an interesting conversation, because I haven't heard a lot of talk. I know at one point a year ago there was talk of a data center coming to, you know, or just discussed for Baldwin County, but that died out, and you haven't heard anything about it and I haven't heard anything for Mobile County or Baldwin County. There's actually only, from just some of the people I talked to, there's only a certain amount of places that you could even put those centers, because they have to have a certain type of, you know, utility structure in there to kind of actually operate them. And so there's not that many places that I think they could even, I think there's maybe three or four in Baldwin County that actually you could put those locations, but I haven't heard any talk of anything that with Baldwin County. Now, do I think that the state of Alabama through other counties and stuff are probably going to at some point do it? You know, yeah, I definitely believe it. I think that you've seen the Trump administration push for data centers, and then I believe, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe, you know, even incoming governor, you know, should he win, obviously he will, you know, most likely, Tupperville is pushing for data centers as well. So I do think you're going to see several pop up in Alabama, and maybe in some of these other areas, like, you know, that, you know, that the because they do increase, like, as far as obviously these companies are paying tons of money for these centers, and some, so you may see it in, you know, a smaller, you know, less fortunate little community area somewhere in the state of Alabama.
Yeah, we have to talk about it, because I think, you know, what I hear is, you know, people are saying, well, they're coming, whether you like it or not, they're coming. And I agree, they're coming. But I think to do it responsibly, and you know, we don't have a lot of statistical data on them and how they affect the water or the communities, the noise, pollution, and all kinds of stuff. So I think kind of slowing down and just taking a look at how it affects the communities that they're put in is so important, because especially, like you said, there's not a lot of places where you can put them, so you need a lot of land. And if you go out to the more rural areas, you have, you know, people that can be possibly low income. They don't have, you know, if you're putting one next to somebody's, you know, where they live, their property value is going to go down. No one's going to want to purchase their home if they decide they want to move and sell it. And then you also have the, you know, the financially, they're kind of stuck if they can't sell their home and move. And so I think there's definitely, and if their water's contaminated, I mean, I've seen in Virginia, there's a community where their water is literally coming out of the faucet and it looks like chocolate milk. And so no one's going to buy your home, and you can't afford to just leave. And so I think I think it's important that we really take some time to look at the quality of life and make sure that, you know, we can do this responsibly.
Well, I agree, and I'm sure there's a lot of groups out there that are digging into this data that have a lot of information and stuff, and I think it's an educational system where people start to need to get educated on them as well. I mean, even me, you know, so I do agree with that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So what do you think on affordable housing? Because that's – oh, are we taking a break? Okay, stick around, Angelo. We will be right back. We'll be right back.
All right.
Just what I had, but honey, now I do.